The book of Revelation has to be one of the most difficult books of the Bible. For any reader of the Bible, Christian or not, it may be your first time that you're just visiting and you open up the Bible. I want to know what the Bible is like. What do these Christians believe? And you open it up and read a book like Revelation and you have no idea what those Christians believe. But I love this book. It's a book, the more I study, the more I read, the more I learn, the more I love it. Absolutely love it. I love the way the imagery works. You might call taking two chapters at a go on a single sermon ambitious, or you might have some other words for it. But I want to dive into it anyhow. Some of you are artists, at least I hope so. I always hope the church is filled with artists. And I think artists can and should have a special appreciation for Revelation. It's not realist art, art that's trying in some way to mimic reality exactly. So all the proportions are exactly right, the distances between objects, everything, you're trying to make it realistic. Revelation is not like that. It's more like certain kinds of expressionist art, whether that's visual art, where the lines are overdrawn, the proportions are all out of proportion. The colors are bold and striking and run together, maybe, and all of those things. Or lots of musical arts run in the same way. But that's the nature of this kind of art. And it is art. We should read it as art, as painting scenes in front of us, living scenes. It's imagery that piles up, one symbol piling on another. And the symbols aren't things that have to be decoded. There are lots of readings of Revelation that tend to work this way. You find the decoder ring at the bottom of the cereal box. You go and you bring it to the book of Revelation and you say, wow, that in their world means this in our world. When I was a child, I had a teacher who decoded Revelation this way so that Russia, which when he was young was a much more significant part of his thinking, was found all over the place in the book of Revelation. I had no idea. But the symbols are not codes that have to be decoded. They are like the paint strokes. They are the colors used to make the scene work, to give it life. These two chapters, chapters 4 and 5, are the opening scenes of the main bulk of Revelation. They set the tone and the message for everything that comes afterward. But to understand it, you have to imagine what it might be like to walk into the throne room of an ancient king, even a warlord. We use the term warlord for what they used to say, king. Do you imagine you would see if you walked into one of these ancient throne rooms? You would see the throne. It's pretty obvious. It's why they call it a throne room, at least I'm guessing. You see the throne front and center where the king would sit, whether it's raised on a platform or some other way of making sure it is the central thing there. If it was a great kingdom, you might also see either the nobles sitting around, they are the only other ones allowed to sit, or lesser kings, subservient kings, ones who paid tribute to the great king, who were also there, represented, and in their own seats. You would have art, beauty, all around on the walls, whether that was taken from conquered kingdoms or just expressions of how great our kingdom is. The room would be filled with it. And, of course, you would have the great army there, representatives of the army. The warriors of the king, the elite guard, the Roman Praetorian Guard, if you're familiar with Roman history. David's mighty men, if you're familiar with the biblical narratives. When the king holds court, the warriors are there. Everything about the room was meant to ooze power and strength, to let you know in whose presence you were standing. You felt your place there, or you were meant to, at least. This is how John paints the scene in Revelation, like an ancient throne room. You walk in, and of course, you have the throne at the center. But now everything is on this tremendous scale, the great and terrifying throne room of heaven. He's called up there by a voice like a trumpet. It's not a polite request. John, if you don't have anything else going on, you might want to see this. It's a voice like a trumpet that breaks in and calls him up. Come up here. See what the world looks like here in the throne room. Why people imagine heaven to be a fluffy, quiet, peaceful place of soft harps and long flowing beards is beyond me. Gary Larson's effect, maybe. But it has absolutely nothing to do with the Bible. It is a terrifying place where John finds himself. The great throne of God in the center, and the one on it, in keeping with all of biblical precedent, has no description, no image given, except beauty, jasper, carnelian, a rainbow that's like emerald. Around that throne are the 24 nobles, or lesser kings, representatives of those under his rule. 24, presumably, the 12 apostles and the 12 tribes of Israel, the united people of God of all time, all there, represented in God's presence. The four great living creatures that are right around the throne, representing the strength of creation of the earth, a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle in flight, all of which symbolize and carry strength. We could go through all of the symbols here, but I think you get the point. The strength of God, the angels, the warriors of God. Angels are not chubby babies with cute faces. They're not even pretty adults with nice, smooth, Pantene hair. They are the warriors of God. There's a reason everyone who sees them falls on their face in fear. They are God's warriors. They come into the scene just after the reading stops. Everything here oozes power, authority. It's a scary place to find yourself if you're John, because everything is here. All the strength of heaven and earth, right here, in the throne room of God. And the great point, just like an ancient throne room, what is said and done here determines everything else in the kingdom. What that king says when sitting on his throne governs his kingdom. And that's where John finds himself, where God determines what happens in his kingdom, which, as the hymn, the second hymn here makes clear, means all things which he created. I wonder what it would be like to see that kind of a sight. I think Minnesotans have a word for it, right? Oofta? Is that something like that? Even in the form of a vision, you find yourself in the throne room of the God of heaven and earth with God himself, all his mighty host, the people of God, the strength of creation, all right there in front of you. But all of that is just background. That's the scene, the canvas on which the action now takes place. John looks and he sees a scroll sealed with seven seals, completely sealed. Seven was used for a complete set. 7 days is the week. A complete sealing of this scroll. No one can open it. The writing on inside and out probably comes from the world of legal text. You would take a scroll and you would write maybe your will or the deed to a property on it. And then you would roll it up and you would seal it and you would write on the outside the dying will and testament of so-and-so, so people would know what it is without having to open it. But not just anyone can open a will or any legal text of that sort. Only somebody who has a right to open it. Only the children who are allowed to open the will can do so. Not just anybody. The language of someone being worthy to open the scroll here has to do with that. No one can be found who has a right to open this scroll. And the scroll has become clearer in the later chapters. The scroll holds God's saving judgments of the world, for the world. His planned determination to save the church, to tear down injustice, and to bring, establish righteousness on the earth. The seals each get broken one after another, bringing about the judgments of God on the earth until finally war is ended by war and it spends itself. Disease spends itself. Everything, until all that is left is justice and peace at last. The world that hates Christ and his church, whether real or symbolic, it all comes to a close. That's what the scroll is, and no one can open it. God is determined to bring righteousness and justice to the world, and nobody, the whole of creation is there, and no one can do it. None of the elders, none of the great creatures, none of the angels. John weeps. Of course John weeps. We're in heaven itself. All of the might of the people of God, all the might of creation, the armies of God, nobody can be found worthy with a right to open that scroll, to end sorrow and grief, and to end the suffering of God's people under so much injustice of so many different kinds. Think of what it was like in a day of persecution for the church, like John's day when he's writing this and having these visions. It may have been local, sporadic kinds of persecution, but that's not a great comfort to you if you're in that locale. You had martyrs. John would have known some who had died already by this point. All or nearly all of the apostles would be put to death for holding fast their confession. And it was wearying to feel under the thumb of the powers of the day. Is there to be no justice for the martyrs? That's the question here. Is there to be no justice brought on the earth at last? One of the taglines of modern philosophy is, there is no final arbiter of truth. Some of you may have heard this in your university classrooms. Philosophy 101, philosophy professors love this kind of thing. There is no final arbiter of truth or judgment. All we have is power. We have language. It's language all the way down. Language on language on language. And whoever controls the narratives, controls the language, it's all power play. And that's all we have left. No final judge. It's not very far, actually, from the point here. There is no one who can open the scroll. It's just left to the creation, the creatures, and they have no right to it. They can't bring out justice. Some of you, I'm sure, saw the video of the martyrs executed back in February. 21 Christian men from Egypt went to Libya for work. Did you see these videos? Has anybody seen these? They were on all the news websites. They weren't well-educated men. They weren't theologians, great spokesmen going over as evangelists or great pastors and teachers or whatever. They were working-class Christians who went over because they needed a job. And they were taken and beheaded on video, made to look as if they were on a beach. They'd been held 3 weeks, some much longer, under the threat of converting to Islam or being beheaded publicly. Not one of those 21 men denied Christ. In the opening scene of the video, it splashes words across telling us who we're watching being beheaded, and it calls them people of the cross. It's meant as derogatory, but it's like Pilate's sign when Christ is crucified, right? Speaking far better than they know. People of the cross is right. It's just 6 months ago. Now you can feel the tension if you were John, maybe, you were called up to the heavens and you knew these men firsthand. You don't even have to be their wife. Maybe you just went to church with them. And then the next Sunday rolls around, you find yourself in God's own throne room, and all of a sudden you find out there is no one even there who can bring justice to the earth. And all of the weariness that the church feels under injustice, what else do you expect John to do but weep? It can be weary to keep believing and to wonder if justice is going to come. The last months here in our own country demonstrate something of how weary it is even for us. I think about the whole mess that arises from the shootings in Charleston. And I feel it a lot more keenly than I used to, because one day I'm going to have to explain to my son and my daughter why some people will hate them because they are black. And the people that hate them look like me. I don't want to have that conversation with my son. This is injustice of a deep sort that came to the surface. Or think of the cold disregard for the life and dignity of the most helpless. The videos that keep being released from the whole mess around Planned Parenthood. For all of the compassion I feel towards those women who have had abortions, and I have friends I'm including here, I have felt something of helplessness and hopelessness and shame too. And for all the compassion I feel there, to see the videos from those doctors was chilling. And in a world that doesn't care, it is weary. The world has so much injustice. And if you march up to one injustice like the shootings in Charleston, and you peel it back, what do you find underneath? What did that boy, that young man, suffer in his life? I have no idea. What kind of world did he grow up in that made it so that it seemed just fine to do what he did? How many injustices were there? And then you peel that back, and how far, how deep do these things run all the time? We already weep simply having to wait and look at it from where we sit. Imagine standing in God's own throne room and everything is silent because nobody can open that scroll and make things right again. No one. And that's when someone leans over to John. John, stop weeping. Not that the weeping was wrong, but John, look. Someone is coming. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered. He can open the scroll and its seven seals. Typical out of Revelation, image on image on image. A lion who is a root, all language from the prophets, who is a slain lamb, who holds all power, seven horns, horns as symbols of strength, holds all power, all knowledge, seven eyes and seven spirits in all the world. And a lamb, so a lion who is a root, who is a lamb with all power, all knowledge, who, have you ever seen a lamb reach out and grab a scroll? Image on image on image on image on image on image. Meant to overwhelm us. He can open it. Finally, someone has come who will set all things right, who is worthy to it. The text goes on to read that at that moment, all of heaven and earth burst into singing. They sing that new song that we read, and then it goes on that myriads and myriads and thousands of angels, along with all of creation, they sing. Relief. These aren't pretty nice little songs and ditties. These are victory songs, feast songs that they sing. The at last for which the martyrs long. At some point in popular Christianity, The work of Jesus and salvation became something of an individualized experience. It's about getting you as an individual to heaven, away from all the ills and pains of this world. It's escape theology, getting out of here. Now, don't hear me wrong. Not all of that is bad. It's certainly not all wrong. I have felt enough sorrow and shame, I'm sure you all have, and anger and grief and injustice and weariness to feel the relief at the prospect of being free. It's an old spiritual, soon I will be done with the troubles of this world. I felt that. But we truncate our gospel if we leave it there. That still would be news worth proclaiming as good news to the world. God has given a way out. That would still be good news. But here, that's a drop in the bucket of good news. Look at verse 9 of chapter 5, if you have it there in front of you again. You have a perfect summary of what Christ's death and resurrection means for us as individuals. For you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God. That is a great summary text of what it means, what Christ did for your sake, to ransom your life from death. But even here, that is set in this bigger scheme. That is the first thing. You stop proclaiming there, it might be good news, but it's not all the good news. He did all those things so that, what? He can tear open that scroll and bring justice everywhere. Everything is on the line here. Escape is not victory. And the heavens are awash in victory here. Of course, everything erupts. St. Paul says the earth itself is groaning, waiting for the day of redemption. Of course, earth erupts in victory. Finally, someone has come who can set all things right. The rest of the book goes on. Revelation continues from here. There will be lots of bloodshed in the book of Revelation, even appalling bloodshed, as death is defeated by death, disease by disease. The martyrs still stand up and cry out, "How long, O Lord? Bring it about, finally." But everything takes place after this. One appears who is worthy to break those seals and to open the scroll. John naturally had to go to church after this. I don't know if you've ever thought about what that might be like. You go from hearing the angels and archangels singing holy, 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 to meeting in your little church singing the same hymn and you're looking around. You call that singing? I've wondered sometimes if John was ever disappointed when he came back and went to his little house church. It was a weary church, no doubt. Harried, there on this little island, removed from all of his family, his connections, his friends, the imprisonment that he was under here. But to be honest, I don't think he was disappointed when he gathered with the church and heard them singing the Sanctus, the holy, holy, holy. I think probably what he saw was every time the church gathered, he felt in his bones our voices being added to theirs right now. We are right now entering what is really real. What God has determined in the heavens. And here, in this place, in our small and struggling churches, we enter that truth. That Christ, our King, has come and is worthy to open the scroll. Come, Lord Jesus.